found this in Ganarum. Ganarmir ni.
What is it?
Well, it's a performance.
Welcome to Synthaholics, guys. This is your host, David Duncan, and with me as always...
Exdal resident of City Alpha 5, Aaron O'Brien.
And...
Faith Hertzberg.
And today we're continuing our con saga.
Yes, this is the greatest day of all days.
He's not at all excited.
This is going to be the greatest episode we've ever done.
Don't set people up for disappointment.
I'm just super excited. We're talking about Wrath of Khan, Star Trek II. This is by far my favorite Star Trek movie ever. I mean, I grew up with it. I saw it in the movie theaters. I think it's amazing. Actually, it's probably. I know this might make some people crazy, but it's my maybe number one sci-fi film ever. It goes over Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back and all that. So this is it for me.
Because this is Star Trek, and this is awesome.
Well, I mean, like, you know, there's other things I like out there, but, you know, like, I like the 80s Dune movie and stuff like that. You know, that's one of my favorites, but I mean...
Well, Jean-Luc Picard's in that one, so that makes it legit.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, but I kind of wanted to back you on that, Aaron, because like this really was like the movie to set the movies for everything else for me too. So it was like, I can understand that.
Yeah, and the cool thing about it is that I saw it as young age, and there's a lot of things obviously I didn't get at a young age, and as I got older and as the years progressed, and I've seen it intermittently through the years, I started understanding more and more themes that were being taught. Talked about in there.
Yeah, definitely. Like Star Trek VI is my personal favorite, but Star Trek II is right behind it.
Yeah, no, VI is amazing too. Don't get me wrong, but this is it for me. I grew up. This is like I was in like second, third grade when this came out. I was like, oh my god! So
I wasn't even born yet.
I wasn't even born yet either.
All right, shut up.
I was like,
Aaron's
up
like,
later.
Aaron's pulling out his cane and beating us.
Quiet, you whippersnappers!
I think the
get
first.
My lawn.
I want to say the first Star Trek movie I saw in the theaters was Star Trek IV. But I mean, my dad was a Star Trek fan, so I mean, we had watched reruns, and then like I'm sure he bought the VHSs and stayed up till midnight to pick. No, he probably wasn't that. He probably picked them up the next day. But yeah. I don't know if you know if they did midnight releases for movies way back then.
Not back then, no. But I mean, you could easily get them. And like HBO,
he remembers clearly.
HBO had Wrath of Khan on for like a long time. That's where I saw it multiple times in the 80s.
Yeah, so like my dad had them on VHS. It's pretty much as soon as they came out, or the Christmas after they came out at the very latest. So like they were probably played many times as a child when I was growing up.
Right. So Wrath of Khan, easily one of the most iconic movies of all the Star Trek movies,
with one of the most iconic soundtracks of all time.
Oh my God, this soundtrack is just it. This is like. James Horner just really nailed it here, and I can't get enough of it. I listen to it sometimes on YouTube when I just as a background music, but I can't literally find the soundtrack. Like literally, like I've tried to find it and order it, and I can't find it anywhere.
Is it iTunes?
It's not. They have like abbreviated like, you know, like it's not the full soundtrack.
Oh, that stinks.
Yeah, it's weird. So. If anybody's out there listening and they have extra soundtrack and they want to burn me a disc or anything or send me the files, I would sincerely love you for it.
Yeah, you can send that to synthaholics@yahoo.com.
And I'll put it on my my little device and I can just do my work around the house, listen to Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. So, anyways.
Aaron in his maid outfit and his broom.
Oh, he would be so happy. I mean, I would pay for videos just to watch him clean his house while listening to Star Trek. Like, he would be the happiest guy on earth.
I've literally done that. I'm not when nobody's at home. I'll turn my computer, all the speakers way up, and I'll just work, and I'll be doing my work, and I'll have Wrath of Khan.
Too bad there's no lyrics in it, so you can sing into the broom.
No, that's for my Stones albums. I put those on. So. Anyways, so this is great. So this is this movie came out in 1982. So this came out. A couple years after they did the motion picture, although it's supposed to take place a couple years, like quite a few years.
Yeah, I think it's like 10 years.
Yeah, after the motion picture was supposed to release, so in Star Trek universe time. And we see Kirk is now Admiral. Spock is the captain of the Enterprise. He's training a young crew, and they're basically wrapped into this plot of Khan as he escapes his planet to seek vengeance on Kirk.
Leave it to Chekhov to screw everything up.
Yep, exactly. So we should probably start at the beginning, just a couple of things. Obviously, we start off the first time we see the Kobayashi Maru, the test. We start off with Savick in command of the Enterprise Council.
I think it's funny that they're calling it the Enterprise, and like I think they're doing it just to screw with everyone who's watching it for the first time.
It is definitely
because it's like, why is there a girl and captain of the Enterprise, and like what's going on?
And again, like you got to
more importantly, why is there a Vulcan in command of the Enterprise?
Yeah, well, the thing is, you start. I mean, you got to put yourself back in 1982, and it's like, you know, people had just seen motion picture.
Someone we don't know.
Yeah, and you're sitting down, and you're like, okay, here's they show Spock, they show Uhura, and then there's Bones. And Sulu, and all of a sudden, who turns around the chair? It's not Kirk. Who is that chick? And it's Lieutenant Savick.
Exactly.
That's Christy Alley.
A young Christy Alley before she became super famous. So
this was her first movie premiere, period.
Yeah.
The only thing she was on before that was a show, which was really cool.
Yeah, no. And then, so this was like it. This is like, nobody knew who she was, and they're like, who is that? So, I think that was the teaser. Like
it was great.
Yeah, they're like, who is it? I mean, if you imagine you've first seen it. And there were a lot of rumors at the time that
Spock was going to die. And so they kill him off.
They kill him beginning.
And like the first 5 minutes of the film.
Yeah, when the Klingon vessels attack the simulation and everything blows up, Spock falls down dead.
Why is the test impossible? Like, do the Enterprise just have no shields? Or I just don't understand
it's
why.
It's just that they're against three against one, and there wasn't a good way to win. With those kind of odds, the other thing is that there was an interview with General McChrystal. I was reading about how they do that with their soldiers. They have actual tests with their soldiers to test their character. They have like these.
It's a stress test.
Yeah, they say they send them in and say these students have been captured by these terrorist group. You have to save the students, but what happens is during the test, some of their teammates get wounded, and they have to decide, are they going to take the students or are they going to bring their soldiers back? And they have to make those decisions. There's no wrong or right answer. It's just to see what their actions are and what it tells about them.
Yeah, what their tactics are.
And
what their breaking points are, like where they'll finally crack or fracture, and whether or not they're fit to continue.
Right, and then they debrief it and they do they study what happened and what they could do, what better ways they could do it. And it's one of those things in command that you have to do, especially if you're an officer. So, This is a little teaser, like I said, this is the first time we see the Kobayashi Maru test. This is the first time we've seen this ever, and
first time we've heard of it.
Yeah, and it gets mentioned over and over again. So
it becomes a staple of Star Trek.
So after obviously the Enterprise is going to be destroyed by the cruisers, the doors open.
I love how like the view screen's a giant door.
Yeah.
And like Kirk is shining in light, like he's Jesus.
Sort of like a godlike figure walking through. And
what a way to introduce your lead. Mm-hmm. What a way. I mean, that's just brilliant.
Shatner probably ate that up.
Shatner probably has that GIF on loop. It just watches it. It's got a computer screen dedicated to it.
Right. Exactly.
Alternate, like, Twitter tag for him.
Yeah. So
this is my Monday face.
So the rest of the training crew, they all leave, and Kirk, gives the advice to Savick is how we deal with death is at least how we deal with life, and words that he doesn't really really believe in the end.
No, he doesn't.
But he's ready to dispense his wisdoms to anybody he wants to. So from there, he meets up with Spock outside, and he makes a little joke that, aren't you dead?
Oh, it's an insult to injury.
And Spock gives him, or he talks about the gift that he gets, the Tale of Two Cities book, and he reads, is the best of time is the worst of times, and he was like, a message, Spock. And
none that I can think of, except for happy birthday. And there's a guy vacuuming in the background. Like, haven't they heard of iRobots, the thing that just vacuum, on their own?
Little Roombas. So there we have the Spock's going to the Enterprise to get things ready for inspection, and Kirk's like, where are you going? He's like, I'm going to go home, because Kirk is obviously, we're seeing him as the old curmudgeon.
Burnt out
curmudgeon person. So next scene we see him is in his apartment. McCoy comes to visit him.
Brings him some Romulan ale for birthday.
Yeah.
And Kirk is really hoping for some Klingon aphrodisiacs, but Bones disappoints him.
Yeah. So Bones gives him some glasses.
Because Kirk is allergic to eye fixing medicine.
Yeah, and as I read too, is the director Nicholas Meyers wanted to give him something, humanize him a little more, show that he's getting older. So he gave him the glasses to give him like something a little we can all identify with. Then McCoy, Bones gives him the kind of lecture, is like, what's going on with you, because you're acting like this is like the end of the world because it's your birthday.
You're acting like it's a funeral, not your birthday.
Right. And McCoy basically says, you took this desk job and you shouldn't have taken it. You should have stayed in command. And that's basically the end of it. So McCoy had the right diagnosis right away. He knew Kirk pretty well. So,
medicine. Be new captain and find the ladies.
Find the green women. Blow up the Klingons.
Those are the three things Kirk does.
Meanwhile, we see the USS Reliant. They're in the SETI Alpha system. They're researching a lifeless planet for the Project Genesis. Reliant is command with Captain Terrell and with a
officer, Pavel Chekov.
Pavel Chekov, right. On this vessel, too, as we discussed before, is also Lieutenant, or now I think he's Commander Kyle, which is in the original Space Seeds episode. He's the guy sitting in the communications chair. So he has the goatee. So he actually did meet Khan.
Yeah, well, I mean, it works. I mean, because, Chekov could have just been, one of the guys running around in the background somewhere.
Well, it's
never stated that he joined the Enterprise after Space Seed. It's just he didn't join the cast, which doesn't mean anything.
Right, and some people, I think there was some, fan fiction, but some novelization that said that Chekov was one of the guys that was actually fighting Khan outside the engine room before he took it over in Space Seed.
That's plausible.
That's why he knew him,
That's plausible.
Why he knew his name, I don't know, but...
Well, I'm sure he read the crew compliment whenever he was reading.
And memorized everybody.
Yeah, he memorized everybody. Well, his perfect brain just takes everything in.
Right.
But they've got orders to find a planet with nothing on it, not even a microbe, because that would just screw everything up with this whole Genesis project that they're, helping the scientists, work on.
Right.
So, they see a ship and, let's go take a look. I'm like, what? Shouldn't you just beam up? I'm like, oh, well, it's going to have microbes on it. It's a ship.
Well, I think they're also thinking, well, if these are survivors from a crash, we might want to rescue them.
Nah. We're not a humanitarian society.
Well, and that's the thing. So they find the wreckage of Khan's crew. They go into it, and it's a great scene.
I love how they have airplane belt buckles. Let's say Botany Bay.
Yeah. He reads. Chekhov reads.
Botany Bay.
Oh no! And they, you know, we gotta get out. And like, he won't even explain to Captain Terrell why.
We gotta go.
And he's like, why? What's wrong? And he won't even tell him.
I just don't understand why they don't request to beam out immediately. It's just like, I mean, like, where are they gonna go? It's not like they took a shuttlecraft down.
Right.
Like, where are they going to?
I don't know.
I don't.
That's just one of those things. So
as far from that spot as possible.
Yeah, but they get the they run, so Khan and crew are there. They take them hostage. Basically, Khan explains what exactly happened because they assumed they were in SETI Alpha 6, but they were actually on SETI Alpha 5.
So how come they can't count the planets?
Yeah, that doesn't – that well, makes advanced very little
scanners.
Sense.
How come they can't count how many planets are in the system?
Yeah. So that makes very little sense why they would not know that the SETI Alpha system was minus one planet.
I think they just went up to the first, like, a dead-looking planet they went to. Oh, this must be SETI Alpha 6. They didn't even check.
Right. And he explains that SETI Alpha 6 exploded, SETI Alpha 5. Basically, because of the explosion, the orbit was shifted and the whole planet went into like a complete chaos. So it wasn't the beautiful planet it was before. Now it's a complete wreck.
And Khan's beautiful, abuse-hungry wife has passed away.
Yes, she has.
From this cataclysm.
Right.
So I think he mentioned it only happened 6 months after they originally dropped off. So his wife didn't live very long.
No, it didn't. And there's a couple things that we were discussing before. That,
well, no, the SETI eel killed her. It wasn't the conditions.
Yeah, he said that. Yeah, the eel killed her. Killed her, right.
So but maybe she lived for longer than 6 months.
But it wasn't a good time afterward.
Oh, she was already subservient enough. So he realized that these things make them even more susceptible to suggestion.
So he was like,
wow, she's way better than she used to be.
She doesn't even like give it a thought now.
She doesn't like contradict me at all.
In reality, in real life, they were in casting. They were actually going to cast the actual actress for. MacGyver.
The poor lady had MS.
She had multiple sclerosis, and she was actually bound to a wheelchair, and they thought it would be disrespectful if they cast somebody else in her place.
Well, I mean, it actually makes more sense to the plot that she is dead because it gives Khan that revenge angle.
Right. There was another thing I read that they actually Khan had a child as well.
Well, there's like a trilogy of books, I believe, that Chronicle Khan's time in between Space Seed and Wrath of Khan. My brother read it. He said it was really good. I have not read these
books. No, but there's literally supposed to be scenes in the director's cut that where they actually show a child on the Reliant.
Oh yeah, I remember reading about the that scene.
Yeah, and they obviously cut it, but you know, it was just one of those like, wow, why? Anyways,
they should have had the baby up on the Reliant and, you know, hanging out and like spinning on the chair or something like that.
I said, woo! No, I heard that they actually, when he engages the Genesis torpedo at the end, that the baby's actually in the transporter room.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think which is like even more fucked up. I mean, it's like your babies are like, blow it up. My baby's on board. You know? So, anyways.
Yeah, he forgot to put the sticker on the Reliant's window.
Yeah, baby on board. So now he has Chekhov and Terrell, and this little slug eel or whatever thing.
SETI Alpha eel.
They he uses that and he puts it in their helmets and it goes into their ear to control their brain. So they make him susceptible to suggestion. This is actually for Star Trek pretty.
This is probably the most gruesome thing in any of the Star Trek movies.
Yeah, I mean, other than maybe seeing some things with the Borg, this is like the first time we see anything.
But it's kind of
like
scary,
that.
And it's also early 80s for Star Trek, so I mean, this is like kind of intense for Star Trek.
Oh, yeah, this is like crazy. It's like when that came out, it was like, whoa. I mean, That was a lot.
Especially the giant ear that takes up the entire screen.
Yeah.
Check off your ear.
And actually the prop to it is a giant ear.
Yeah, yeah, it was. They made a giant ear.
It's huge.
So they could animate the animatronic to go into it.
And that was one of those things that was like when it was on, it was like, oh, wow, that's crazy. And it was like really like you were freaked out when you saw it. Like, oh, this is – because, I mean, you go back. I mean, all we had was the 60s TV show. Obviously the animated series.
There's nothing scary in that.
Nothing like that. And then motion picture, there's really nothing scary. So it's
The Gorn might have been scary if he wasn't hilarious.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there was never anything like that gruesome, that like intense, you know. So this was like, whoa, this is guys. Again, Khan showing his awful side, so. The other thing, which is we talked about before, is the Butney Bay's crew all seems to be in their young 20s.
I bet Khan fathered all of them as soon as the thing landed.
But they're not his children. They are actually supposed to be the crew of the Butney Bay. It doesn't make sense.
They're all like 20.
It doesn't make sense.
I don't remember a bunch of 4-year-olds taking over the Enterprise.
It makes no sense, but it's that's exactly what they are supposed to be. I mean, he makes a comment to Chekhov, said these men and women have, will live and die by my side 200 years before you were born. So, I was actually in the impression too, because I always thought that the second command, I think his name is Joachim, was his son, but it wasn't. It's just the second command. It's not his son at all.
Just some dude.
Yeah. And this is his way to get off the SETI Alpha 5 by taking over their brains, and obviously they get up.
And then he maroons the crew of the Reliant on SETI Alpha.
It's got to be rough, too.
5.
So
it's just like, oh, we're here. You're going to be all beamed down now.
Right. Then we get back to the Enterprise where they do the inspection, and they let Savick pilot the Enterprise
out of space dock,
and Kirk has the look of the father giving his 16, 17-year-old the keys to the car for the first time. Let him drive away.
They also established a precedent of like a quarter impulse for leaving space dock. Even the space dock is completely different next time we see it.
Yeah. And then
I mean, it's just like a hallway. I mean, like, I don't see why you can't go any faster than half impulse out of that, but, you know.
I wouldn't profess to be a professional in piloting starships, but I'm sure.
Just imagine the amount of damage you would do if you twitched.
Yeah, if you just like wiggled the steering wheel a little bit.
Yeah, but thousands just died.
Yeah, but even more so in the Star Trek III space dock. That's that space station. Like, how big is this thing where something can move at a quarter impulse and still take several seconds to get? Right. Impulse is fast.
Yeah.
It's sublight, but still, it's still really fast.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. No. It's not slow. They get a call from Carol Marcus that Kirk gave some order to take Genesis, which was not the case whatsoever.
Chekhov is just like smiling. It's like, yes, it's from the admiral.
It's from
everything's okay.
Admiral James D. Kirk.
He's like, he has to check. He's like, he waits for a second before he answers.
Yeah, because he knows it's a complete lie. And there we get the she calls him. The communication's all messed up.
Why doesn't Captain Terrell call? Like, why is the second guy in command like making the call?
I don't know. Who knows?
Probably it's because he's not one of the main characters.
Yeah, we know and love Chekhov, so that's probably why. So Kirk was going to investigate. There's a great scene. Actually, one of my favorite scenes of this movie is he goes to Spock, and Spock's sitting there meditating in his room.
Oh, the lines there are awesome. Like, it made me tear up a little bit.
Yeah, it's
like
great.
Just listening to them talk about that stuff. Oh, so good.
Yeah, and he makes a comment to you know, like Kirk saying you should take command, and he goes, "I have no ego to bruise. You know, you should. If we go on active duty, you should be the one taking command." And he makes a comment to Kirk. He says, "You know, command is your best destiny. Is anything else is just a waste of material. And I thought that was just perfect because, I mean, that is who Kirk is. Anything else is just, you know, shouldn't even be happening. So takes command of the ship. They're heading off to regular one to see what's going on.
Because Carol calls.
Yeah.
And the video's coming through almost perfect, but the audio's not coming through for whatever reason.
Yeah, and they can't.
They're being jammed at the source.
Yeah, you can't. They can't really discern what's actually happening.
Only Lone Star would give Shatner the jam.
Oh.
Lone Star.
Lone Star.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That was a first. And
a Spaceballs reference?
Yeah, we haven't done that.
Yeah, yet. that was a good one.
And there we have the first time we get Khan the Reliant intercepts the Enterprise on their way, and that's when Khan they kind of play possum like there's nothing wrong, and they just open fire on them. So it's a great sequence, you know, that they're the whole little fight scene between them. Anything you want to put onto that?
Yeah, I mean, it was a nice little fight scene. Kirk is just letting him get in close, and then last second, shoots him.
Yeah.
I like the deception where they're like, oh, I need the information on Genesis, and Kirk's like, we need a minute. Our computer's messed up, you know. Yeah, right. Our modem's on the fritz.
Right. Nothing's working.
Our Wi-Fi's not, you know, where it needs to be.
And
the exchange is so awesome between Kirk and Khan. And, like, they didn't even shoot these things anywhere, like, you know, opposite each other at all. Like, I mean, they're doing these completely blind, not acting off each other at all.
Right. And the great thing about it is, too, is that, which I don't think anybody really thinks about now, but 1982, I mean, remember, they hadn't redone the graphics yet, so you still had those old graphics from the 1960s show. You never saw ships fight like that. You saw like in a torpedo shoot, and he's like, you know. this was really cool that seeing these ships firing and the torpedoes and things explode and stuff like that. That you never saw that before. So this was like blowing your mind seeing this combat. Well,
also, like something funny I read on Memory Alpha was that this is the only Star Trek original series movies where phasers fire in a film.
Really?
Yes. Not counting the JJ movie.
Right, yeah.
Because they did shoot phasers in 2009, but the Enterprise did not shoot a single shot the entire Into Darkness, which was really sad. I was like, it gets beat up and it doesn't even fight back.
Wait a second, let me think. What did they fire? I guess they just fire torpedoes
In Star Trek VI, it was only torpedoes.
And they only fired torpedoes at Christopher Lloyd's ship, the Bird of Prey in 3?
Well, Christopher Lloyd shoots torpedoes.
Yeah, what do they fire?
The Enterprise only shoots torpedoes.
Okay.
The only time the Enterprise ever shoots phasers is in Star Trek 2. Because Christopher Lloyd's ship shoots phasers, but that's not the Enterprise.
Okay. Wow, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's really weird. It's like you assume like phasers and torpedoes. That's like the bread and butter of Star Trek fighting. And
right. You
only see the Enterprise shoot phasers in Star Trek 2.
Oh, it's crazy. So
I think the next time you see it, it's in the First Contact.
Well, yeah, there's a lot in there.
Or no, maybe Generations. Maybe they shot fires in Generations. Maybe probably then.
Yeah, I don't know. This was like a ship-to-ship combat, really wild. I even read about Reliant. There was some of the high studio execs were worried that people wouldn't be able to discern what the Enterprise looked like compared to the Reliant because the Reliant had the disc. It's just like the Enterprise.
And they're completely different looking ships.
I know, but, you know, they're always worried about, like, well, they won't know the difference. They're like, why would they not know the difference?
I mean, if they're both Constitution-class ships, then you wouldn't know the difference.
That would be hard to tell.
But, I mean, the Miranda-class Reliant, was great. I love the design of it.
Oh, it's a cool ship.
And, you know, the like I was watching one of the behind-the-scenes things on the DVD before I was watching the actual film. And this guy who was one of the visual effects, I guess, supervisors or whatever, he's a real old guy, like, whenever this was shot. But, like, he was saying, you know, the saucer is what lets you know it's the same design ship. Because, I mean, you can tell American battlecruisers all the different varieties from, you know, Japanese battlecruisers because they have a similar look to them.
Right.
And so this is the Navy, so the saucer is what gives it the similar look, even though the rest of the configuration is different.
Right, right. So, so they have the fight. I mean, obviously, Khan takes them by surprise, but Kirk has the prefix code that he kind of ties into the Reliance computer, and the prefix codes make them drop their shields, and Kirk can get a couple shots in before they
which
can
is
escape.
So cool. It's like hacking before hacking was a thing.
Right.
And it was like he basically hacks into their computer and tells the computer to turn off its shields.
Right. And the cool thing about it is that even like Spock says, you know, he might have changed it. He's quite intelligent. So like there might have been a chance that
maybe they didn't have that in the original schematics design when you read them in TOS.
Yeah, maybe. So I just thought, but it was a cool little thing to figure it out and how they got past that. And obviously, Reliant is disabled, and they fly off, and Enterprise can get away for now until they can make repairs. So, and they go off to Regular One.
And they go into Regular One, and they're searching the place. Savick comes up with some other regulations about it. He needs to be accompanied by somebody.
No flag officer can be down without proper SS armed escorts.
Well, you know, I think that's kind of where they start getting the Riker always telling Picard he can't go down. He's got
yeah.
So Riker.
Well, it makes sense.
It does make sense.
You're gonna send your captain out all the time to do it. That's the one thing about the original series that never made sense. Is like, oh, here's your chief officer. Let's
always going into danger's way.
Put him in the most dangerous situations constantly. You know.
They find a whole bunch of dead people hanging from their feet.
Right.
And then they find Chekhov and
Captain Terrell.
And Captain Terrell.
Locked in a box.
Locked in a box. Two boys, one box, guys.
Yeah.
Very small box, too.
Yeah.
They were cuddling.
Was not.
Well, in that space, you would kind of have to.
Wink, wink.
Khan was like giving them, making them like do all these like nasty things in the box before.
Oh, they're really susceptible to
suggestion.
Yeah, it's like when you say Jadzia. Susceptible to suggestion.
Right.
Is where I get tripped up.
Right. So they. Obviously, the people have been killed from the resident scientists have been killed in Regular One, and they have to I guess all the memory banks have been wiped out as well, and
except for the transporters.
Well, that's a weird thing too. Is that after they get Terrell and Chekhov back on their feet, they're like, "Well, I don't think he ever made it down here," which just seems like a no brainer that they wouldn't have at least checked the transporter room, see where they might have beamed, you know. It seems odd that they wouldn't have done that, you know. But I
guess Khan doesn't think about the transporter that much.
Yeah. So they realize that it's deep underground, and Kirk realized that the Genesis project
is gone.
Well, no, that the original Genesis project was the phase one was supposed to be underground.
Yeah.
And so he figures this is where they went, and McCoy has his misgivings of beaming down into the middle of a dead rock. He says, go where? Suppose they went nowhere. And Kirk makes the quip. He's like, well, this is your big chance to get away from it all.
That was great.
I love that.
Because Bones has issues with the transporter to begin with.
No, he hates transporters, yeah.
You know, if you listen to Warp 11, you should listen to the Ballad of Bones 1 and 2. Two is our outro. But there's a line in there that talks about he couldn't get it up for a couple of days after going to the transporter.
Well, even in the original series, he's complains once in a while. I think, was it?
And in Star Trek 1, he complained about it.
No, Space Seed, he complains about it. He says, getting our molecules scattered all over the universe or like that. And he's like, you know, you're such an old, like you're an old soul or something like that. Or
you're an old country doctor.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways, so they... They beam down to Regular One, and there's these caves that have been,
hollowed out and made into little corridors.
This is
when Terrell and Chekhov make their move.
Right, right. Well, not before a young David Marcus
makes his move
and jumps with a knife. Has a knife fight with his dad. So this is his first real interaction with his dad.
I love earlier when it was the Carol and David are talking. She's like, oh. I remember you used to gallivant with that That Boy Scout.
Kirk, and he goes.
And she's like, if he was anything, he was never a Boy Scout.
Many things, but never a Boy Scout, yeah.
And so it's a good thing that he went to knife fighting school and not Boy Scout school. Because he swiftly beats his son, whose son was probably a Boy Scout.
Right. So David is a real hothead for a scientist. So he attacks Kirk.
Him and his proto matter. He probably sniffs proto matter.
Well, I mean, with that bloodline, the anger doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, right.
Damn.
And this is David thinks that he killed everybody up on the space station, and he goes, "Of course he didn't kill all those people." And it's like, you're just making it hard.
Why would he jump to that conclusion?
Because he just thinks that, David Marcus thinks that everyone in Starfleet is just like some...
is a mat, and we'll put conclusions on it, and then you jump to them.
Yeah, that's exactly what he does. That's what he does. Kill everybody.
Well, he also mentioned...
his favorite game.
Well, he also mentions there was a war between the Federation and the scientists, and there's been peace for over 100 years.
I was like, what?
How did that work?
They didn't mean it like that. It just meant that the Federation has kept peace between planets for 100 years, not a war between the scientists and the Federation.
Starfleet and the scientists. I was like, wouldn't Starfleet totally outgun the scientists?
I don't think that's what they meant. I think you're reading far too literally into that. Just that the Federation...
I just thought it was a funny line that he said. I'm like, oh, we've been at peace for 100 years. I'm like, what?
No. This is when Terrell and Chekov pull their phasers, and they're like, have you been listening, Khan? And Khan's like, I haven't.
Giggity. Yeah. Khan's like, it makes me happy when I hear Kirk voice.
Yeah, exactly. And even David does like, you son of a, and he jumps at Kirk, and who is it? Is it Savick that pulls him back, and he shoots one of the other scientists?
Yeah,
so it's like friend, and he's working, and he's like, because David can't control his temper, he killed one of his friends.
And Dave's sitting on the ground like, he's got a very scared look on his face.
Yeah, he's like, oh wait, I just did that.
Yeah, that wasn't a good idea. Maybe
that was a little.
Maybe I should have rethought that.
Yeah, I wonder if
I regret life choices.
I wonder if he, after that, took some time and reflected killing his friend.
I don't think he did.
No. He's kind of caught.
He's a red shirt. He's basically a red shirt.
Kind of got the Kirk-itis.
No one thinks about those guys.
Because the guy who got killed actually has a couple lines in the movie in the very beginning. So, I mean, it's not nice.
Well, he's complaining about the Federation, so he deserves to get shot by a Federation.
He literally has, like, maybe three lines, but still, he gets shot. So this is where we get the famous scene where Khan wants Terrell to kill him.
And he's like, I want to, but I can't.
I'm lost into Kirk's eyes.
Kirk is just giving me these winks, and I can't.
I can't look away.
I can't shoot the pretty face in that toupee.
This is probably the only thing that kind of falls apart in the movie, really, to me. Is like, why wouldn't he just shoot him? Like, Terrell doesn't have any vested feelings towards Kirk.
He even says he's never met Admiral Kirk ever before.
Yeah. So, I mean...
Maybe he's like, he's just so reverent to the rank of Admiral that he can't do it.
Or maybe that Kirk has become a legend in his own time that he was like, I can't kill this guy. This is like, you know, the poster boy.
So he eats his own phaser.
He does. He kills himself. So he turns it on himself, which is...
And for whatever reason, it makes Chekhov said he'll want to come out too. That doesn't make any sense. But
we'll go with it. Well, maybe it's that whole time as the eels were kind of like not
symbiotic.
Yeah, maybe there were like some part of them that they were fighting for all that time. But who knows? But Chekhov goes down as well. Fortunately, Chekhov does not kill himself.
Fortunately, Bones has some gauze pads that he can hold on his bleeding ear.
That's right. Bones came prepared.
Bones always comes prepared. He always knows what's going to happen.
Although he couldn't save that young midshipman that died, that Scotty was crying about earlier.
Well, that was Scotty's fault. Scotty brought him to the bridge before he brought him to sick bay.
What was up with that?
Yeah, that was bad. Missed
the... Well, Bones does hang out a lot on the bridge. Like in Star Trek The Motion Picture, he's on the bridge all the time for like no reason.
Well,
like he walks in to say a line, then he walks away.
His battle position is in the med bay.
Yeah, and that's the thing is like, okay, so all these young engineers got injured from the fight. And then the next scene, he's in there up in the bridge, and they're talking about going down the regular one. And he goes, "Can you spare anyone?" And Bones goes, "Yeah, I can spare someone. Me." I was like, "Aren't you needed with all those engineers that are all burnt up down in sick bay?
They're all dead.
You should be doing something."
It's like, "Nah, I'd rather just go have some fun.
The nurses can do the body bags. It's fine.
I'm bullshitting on the bridge. Give me a minute."
Yeah, I'm drinking coffee, talking to my friend here.
But I do have to say that Scotty's fault for not taking him directly to sick bay. Maybe Bones could have done something. Maybe if Scotty didn't take that detour.
Yeah, and that's a thing is like, so they gave that midshipman some couple lines in the beginning, kind of give him like humanize him before they kill him, so he felt a little bad for him. So we're back in the Genesis cave,
and she wants to make Kirk feel young again, and she doesn't
wait. We can't go there yet. This is where he picks up the communicator and yells the famous con line.
Oh, wait, everyone knows
that. Yeah, you're
about
to completely steal his thunder.
Come on, this is it. This is like...
Let him have
George
it.
George Costanza literally screams out con in Seinfeld because of this movie is like... Because...
Everyone has screamed out con ever since this has ever happened.
Right. This is like when this movie plays, people from other rooms comes into the room and screams con with Kirk. Just for fun.
And every time William Shatner is turned into a cartoon, he yells con in any series he's ever been turned into a cartoon.
Yeah. And
Family Guy, The Simpsons, you name it. If he's been a cartoon, then he's said con.
Well, in the Seinfeld reference is that when George Costanza's fiance gets killed by licking those envelopes, they make a comment at the gravesite that at the very end of the movie that Bones says, she's not really dead as long as we remember him, and they think that's because they talk about the Star Trek II reference and they're like, oh, that's a great movie, that's a great reference and everything. And later on, they find out that he's going to do his fiance's parents are going to have a remembrance thing for her, and he has to like attend it like 3 days a week or something like that. And George Costanza is like, can't stand it. He doesn't want to have anything to do with her and stuff like that. And he yells out con. So this is, it's like one of those things. It's such a ingrained part of our
And then
society.
George Costanza comes as a guest star on Voyager where he plays in Think Tank.
Yeah, well.
That's not skipping ahead.
Anyways.
Hey, so, we have to connect the reference dots. This is why we're here.
There's a lot, actually.
No, Aaron should totally share off right about now.
Anyways, so he screams out con.
He's totally baiting con. He's not mad.
Well, that's the thing sad. Is, I've thought about this too, because is he baiting con or is he just like pissed off because all the bullshit that con's put him through in the last like maybe 20 some hours?
Maybe he's
just really fed up with that stubborn little brat that's been throwing the temper tantrum.
Well, he knows Khan's been listening the entire time.
And he knows that...
And if he can get Khan to come down to...
Before, they're on the... they're talking. He knows that the Enterprise, the coded message they send between them. So he knows that the Enterprise is going to be fixed before Khan thinks it's going to be fixed. So he knows that. So Kirk's aware of that, and he is trying to get him to come down to the planet to fight him, which is probably a really bad idea.
Since he's feeling so old.
Kirk is 50 years old, and Ricardo Montalban, even not as an augmented human, is like a bodybuilder and in impresso shape for anybody that age. So I don't know if it's going to work in Kirk's favor.
He is strong.
So, but Khan decides he's going to leave him marooned. On regular one, which is Starship's not going to come check it out every once in a couple months or something like that. I don't know. It's so stupid. Anyways, they beam up. Khan beams up Genesis
because they found out where it is since good old Terrell came down to the planet. It's like, we'll share the danger with you, Kirk.
Yeah.
Kirk's like, right. Kirk's just like, you're going to go after the Enterprise. I don't care what you say.
He's like, that's my boy Terrell.
You were locked in a box. Remember what happened with Sisko when he was in the hot box?
Oh, that was awful. Poor Sisko.
So, and this time he was locked in with Chekhov, so who knows what happened. Mm. Anyway,
Russian roulette.
Chekhov was
there.
Smiling later.
Chekhov was actually frowning at that picture you sent us, Faith. He looked so sad that William Shatner was touching him.
I know.
Like, don't touch me, Shatner.
That whole sequence is great.
Don't touch me, Shatner.
The look of discomfort just gets more and more the closer he leans in on him. It was just like, oh, yeah. What is happening here? I don't see everybody's hands. We need a hand check.
This guy's hand on his
X-ray,
bum.
X-ray hands.
This guy's hand on his bum.
And then so now that he's screamed con, Carol Marcus wants to have Kirk feel young again, but she doesn't take off her clothes. She takes him into a big open cave.
Right. And
if you know what I mean.
Oh, my God.
Sorry.
Shame on you.
Carol Marcus.
Oh, that was dirty.
Yeah, that was
no, but they do go to a big open cave.
They do think, and they thought that the the cave they were was like the Genesis, but they said it took them months for them to drill that all, and it's what they did with Genesis and the other cave.
And they did it in a day.
Yeah,
and then the life form started growing a couple of days afterwards.
So it's a like a picturesque paradise underground where the sun
waterfalls and
yeah. Sunlight coming in. They must have put big windows in somehow. I don't know how that works. Anyways,
maybe they said it was like a ball of metal. Maybe they were able to transfer part of the surface into transparent aluminum.
There you go. Nice.
Oh, there's a thought. Good. Well played.
Nice thinking. Transparent aluminum? Would that be worth something?
Aluminium.
To
aluminium.
This is where Savick asks him how Kirk beat the Kobayashi Maru, and Kirk admits that he...
We programmed the test.
He programmed the test. And he basically cheated.
He cheated. He's like, no, I just changed the conditions. That's not cheating. I don't like to lose.
Which is funny, since I got a commendation for original thinking. It's like, when does that ever happen in any reality?
Well, in Star Trek 2009, he's not. He is... Definitely kicked in the balls for that.
Yeah, well, that's because Spock
tattled.
Doesn't like him.
No.
A girl this time around? Yes.
And
good character. I can't smash him too hard.
What's that?
I said the new version is a very good character. I can't smash him too hard.
Well, he calls up Enterprise. Enterprise is ready to beam him up.
And he takes off his big heavy coat and puts on his regular light coat again.
Yeah, and they're off to fight Khan and get the Genesis back from. And they've got the Enterprise reasonably up and working. It's not probably perfect. A lot of things aren't working.
Warp drive's still down.
Yeah.
Only half of primary power.
And
Kirk doesn't really want to fight. Kirk wants to lay a trap.
Yeah, yeah.
He flies right into a nebula.
They fly into the nebula. Well, they know they're not going to be able to get away from them anyways, because they can't just run away from them.
Yeah.
So they go into the nebula where they're kind of their shields won't work. They can't do any tactical displays, so they have to kind of just fly blind and hope they don't like crash into each other or anything like that.
But for flying blind, Kirk finds them really well.
Actually, yeah, and they. I mean, this is another great sequence between the Reliant and the Enterprise. They fight, obviously.
He shoots like the engineering bay where the impulse engines are. Mm-hmm. That little blue dome blows up.
Blue dome.
He shoots the nacelle off of the Reliant. That was like I love the designs in Star Trek, but there's so many weak points on the Enterprise and on the Klingon ships. There's so many like really small weak points and the struts that hold up the nacelles are definitely one of the weak points.
Like,
and,
why
like,
wouldn't you just blow those
that
off?
Was like the perfect thing. You know, he went for it and it was great that they shot the and shot those off.
And you have a burnt up Khan.
Everyone else apparently is dead.
Yeah, he's flying it by himself. And burnt up Khan, and he decides he's going to detonate the Genesis torpedo, and they have a 4-minute countdown. The Enterprise can't get enough distance between them and Reliance.
And the turbolifts aren't really working, so Spock is the fastest climber.
He's like a monkey down those ladders.
He just like slides. He's like doing the fire engine, just like sliding down. Like
maybe they have like the twirly slides in the Enterprise.
I don't. Maybe, but I mean,
he doesn't even use it. He just jumps.
He gets down to engineering with like 3 minutes to spare.
He's like, whee!
All the way from the bridge, and that's not a small ship. Like, he's, like, sprinting.
Right.
You know, I bet if you could actually hear him, this would be the only time you hear a Vulcan giggling.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, except he's going to his death, so maybe he wouldn't giggle at this point.
I never know, it's a Vulcan.
Yeah, true. So, Spock decides he's going to go fix this engine warp engine problem, and McCoy tries to stop him, and he gives him the old Vulcan neck pinch.
It's like, oh, perhaps you're right. How's Mr. Scott? And he goes and pinches his neck, and he's like, I don't have time to debate this with you logically.
And then he does the gives him his Katra, which this is the fuzzy part.
Remember.
Yeah, it's like, remember. Like, if you didn't have Star Trek III, what would that signify?
Yeah, I don't – like, it doesn't – I don't know, like,
because I know they were kind of planning on some of it, but
well, I mean, he does say that line like later, you know, if you remember him, he's not really dead. Maybe that was the only significance of it. Maybe that they were just thinking. But to me, it just makes me think that they were totally like had the outline for Star Trek III planned.
Yeah, it makes me wonder.
It feels that way, but I know it probably wasn't. But I mean, they show the torpedo tube at the very end of the movie,
right?
Like totally fine, yeah. With no scorch marks or anything. It just
didn't like crash into a mountain and explode.
It's in a nice little lush jungle.
Yeah, it just landed softly,
like a little baby.
The landing gears went down. Anyways, So Spock goes into this little room, pulls off the cover, and all this radiation.
Pretty shiny lights
is shooting at him. He's, you know, fixing it and burning his face off at the same time. He basically fixes the warp's engines just before, like less than 30 seconds before Genesis is going to explode. And they take off and they get away just in time. And while they're wondering at the planet forming, he gets a call from Bones that he's got to
get down here quick.
Yeah, and he runs down and he sees that Spock's dying. And this is probably the saddest moment, you know, like where Spock gets up. He's all, face is all burnt up. He bumps into the glass. He can't even see.
He can't see. Yeah, it's just, it's really sad. Like, this is the first time I've watched Wrath of Khan since Leonard Nimoy died.
Yeah.
And I was tearing up and crying again. Yeah. Like it was like it just happened.
Yeah. No, it's,
yeah,
it's,
it was definitely rough to get through that scene.
It's hard to see it. And there's some great lines exchanged between both of them. And they have, you know, he's obviously says, I've always been your friend and those kind of things. And live long and prosper. And obviously he's not going to. And you see a totally crushed Kirk just, you know, fall to the, you know, come to the floor, and they're like head to head.
Yeah, they're just pressed against the glass.
Yeah.
And I know Nimoy died like right before, a couple weeks before our first episode, and that was months ago.
Right.
And like his death is still like so fresh in my mind, and just doesn't help any, like, watching the scene.
Yeah, I watched it a couple times since then. I saw it with my son. They re-screened it at a movie theater in our city. So
I was working that day. I couldn't go. I was so mad.
I know you were. I know. But I've seen it a couple times, and it's it's kind of lost the edge from me. But yeah, it's hard to see, and
it's just there's just so much meaning, and the actors are so in their roles.
You get to see them at their prime, and for me, it's actually been 15 years since I've seen this movie.
Wow.
So I got to see all the best parts of Nimoy all over again. And for me, it was a lot like it was for David. Like, it still gets you. Like, for me, it was just, because I got to see him at the conventions and I got to meet him. And over the last 6 years, I got to see him age significantly. And then for me, I guess maybe because of having had that experience with him, it hits a lot closer to home because he was an inspiration for me. He was my role model.
Yeah. No, I still feel sad when I see it because I do think of, you know, it's not just at his passing, but it's also like what it signifies that, you know, you think about losing somebody like that, you know.
And I mean, like, he was like a family member. Like, I don't ever remember never seeing Star Trek in my house. Like, Like, my earliest memories probably are, like, watching Star Trek with my dad, my mom, and my mom would make pizzas on Saturday nights, and,
too.
We would just watch Star Trek.
Eating
and
dinner and watching Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's, like, you know, totally ingrained in me. And so, like, you know, I was unfortunately never got to meet Leonard Nimoy himself.
But, I never
like,
met him either, no.
But, like.
He was a wonderful man. First time I ever met him, he like hugged it. Me.
That's so awesome.
It stunned me. He was my first celebrity that I ever met, and he was so humble and sweet, and he was actually surprised to meet a fan that was just so excited and grateful to be able to meet him. Like, he was a good man.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he seems like it. But I mean, like I said, like he's like literally like almost like part of the family, because like I can't remember not knowing.
Yeah,
who Spock or Leonard Nimoy was.
Yeah, I mean, I was the same way. It's like it was like just before, like coming home from school, like the hour after school, they would have, you know, Star Trek: The Original Series would be on, and I'd watch it. So it'd be on every day, like 5 days a week. You know, so you'd watch an episode, you know, and you know, it was just one of those things. You know, Spock was there, and you just kind of like you saw the same episodes over the years rerun over and over again. I mean, there's only so many episodes of the original series, so you saw him over and over again, and you got to know Spock. You know, Spock was part of your life, and, you know, to see him die was, like, shocking, you know.
And it was, like, happening. Like, there was no way around it, because Leonard Nimoy didn't want to come back, and he was intrigued that he could get to do a death scene, so he couldn't say no to it.
Right.
And then he also was able to, you know, wrestle directing rights for the third Star Trek movie, which is why I was thinking they already kind of knew that it was happening, because it was basically part of his contract.
Right.
Where, like, if he die, you know, if he comes back, he's going to die, and he gets to direct the next film.
Right. And this thing also I read that during that filming of the thing, it was like a lot of the crew that were filming it were actually like they're crying during the scene of the while they were filming it, and Nicholas Meyers didn't get it. He just did not understand that the emotional connection people.
No,
had
he didn't. And
I mean,
like
of Spock,
and he was just like, "Yes, I'm killing Spock," and like it's not going to matter as long as the story around it's good.
Yeah.
And like he just didn't get. I mean, like he got the military. You know, I liked how he militarized Starfleet and made it look like the Navy. I liked the look of the film. I liked the way it was shot, the way it was directed. It was directed really well done. And it's amazing how well that death scene was directed, even though he didn't understand what he was doing.
I think he still did it with care. It's just that he didn't understand the emotional weight.
Yeah.
He didn't have the connection that a lot of everybody else did. He didn't have that emotional attachment.
Yeah. Exactly. And,
it's a super touching scene. Like, I mean, like, just the dialogue, it gets me. And then the funeral, oh my, and it just makes it, it just like, you know, you get your heart ripped out and here, let's step on it a little bit more.
Right.
Here's some salt. Let's grind it in.
Yeah. And so they're in the.
And once again, the music is amazing at the funeral scene. I love how they have Scotty playing Amazing Grace on the bagpipes.
Yeah, and then they shoot it off.
And then the music changes to what, you know.
Yeah, it swells up. Yeah. It swells to a, like a.
Crescendo where there's a full orchestra instead of just the bagpipe.
Right, and obviously goes on to Planet Genesis. And at the last couple scenes, we have David Marcus confronts his father. Basically tells us.
Which is also great.
Yeah.
It's so good.
He kind of like, you know, where he comes in, it's like, you said to Savick, how you deal with death is at least important as you deal with life. And Kirk
says,
how did
he know that? He wasn't there.
Well, Savick must have told him. I mean, Savick is a Vulcan, so she probably has like a pretty good memory. And Kirk says, well, those are just words. And he was like, those are good words. You should live by them, you know? And Kirk, you know, obviously has issues with that. And, I don't know. There was a lot of things in there that you know. David obviously comes in and says that he's proud to have Kirk as his father. You know, because this is
really touching and really, you know, good of him in the wake of his best friend's death, but also a huge U-turn for how he felt about Kirk.
Yeah,
and the Federation in general at the beginning of the film.
Seeing that about a half an hour ago, they had a knife fight. So,
well, he didn't know who it was.
Wait, you just tried
well,
to kill
you know, him. Kirk's got a handle on resolving bad daddy issues at this point.
Yeah, he's got to be like one of his things he does on a couple like every couple days.
Well, I when I was preparing for this episode, I watched most of it with the director's commentary, and then I listened to it. And so when I was listening to it, the director's commentary, It was really interesting hearing what Nicholas Meyer had to say about Shatner and Montalban in particular. Shatner, he was saying that his acting, like, his best acting came, like, after many, 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 many shoots, because he would just get bored with just, having to do it over and over again. So he'd finally start doing different things, right. And that's how I was able to get some of, like, Shatner's best work. And then with Ricardo Montalban, he actually came in and did his best work in the first couple takes, and he got worse and worse as the takes went on.
Right, right.
So I thought that was really interesting. So it actually worked out really well that they were on screen together at the same time.
Because
you have one of them giving a really bad performance depending on their acting styles.
There's something so great about this, having two adversaries that don't actually really physically meet.
Because even in Space Heat, it didn't make sense, even with that space baton, that Kirk was able to take out Khan.
What? Space baton?
The console lever he pulls out, the baton thing. The baton, it's like a lever thing, stick.
Oh, you're talking about in Space Seed. Okay.
Yeah, in Space Seed. even with that, it doesn't make sense that he would win. I mean, Khan's like five times stronger. He should be able to withstand, some kind of beating.
Are you saying he should have had a thick enough skull?
Yeah. I don't even think he hit him in the head. He just was hitting him in the back. Like in the shoulders.
Dude, you take a couple of hits like that and a metal rod, it's going to put you down. Anyways, that all being said, so they have a touching scene, David and Kirk. And then Kirk goes back to the bridge, and they're watching the planet. And there you get McCoy saying he's not really dead as long as we remember him. And Kirk quotes the last line of... it's not the very last line, but almost the last line of Tale of Two Cities. It's a far, far better thing I do now than I do here, a far, far better place I go to. And he's talking about in the Tale of Two Cities, the character basically is killed. He sacrifices himself just like Spock did. And so there's like a tie-in, literally tie-in of the book and the thing. So he's thinking of Spock and he's like,
Spock got it for him.
Yeah, and it's like something Spock was trying to tell me on my birthday. And it's just great. I just can't – you can't – all these little things folding into each other that just make this movie so cool. The little things like that just like make me go like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's really great. And you can see that he's like learning and growing as a character in this film.
Yeah, that's the best thing about it. You see basically Kirk as kind of like a – curmudgeon. His life is, he's a desk jockey now. He doesn't really like where he's at. And, and he has to make these decisions of how to, fix all these old problems that he's piled up. I mean, I really think this movie is, other than the vengeance of Khan itself, is that we're seeing Kirk trying to make right these wrongs.
And speaking of righting some wrongs...
You are the most beautiful woman in the galaxy. You don't know how long I've wanted to tell you that.
But you're afraid.
Yes.
Of me?
Of us, of what we might become. And you're inviting me in.
I'm not sending you away.
That's more than I expected.
Is it as much as you hoped?
To hope is to recognize the possibility. I had only dreams.
Dreams can be dangerous.
Not these dreams. I dream of a galaxy where your eyes are the stars. Universe worships the night.
Careful. Putting me on a pedestal so high you may not be able to reach me.
Then I'll learn how to fly. You are the heart in my day and the soul in my night.
We lost two more relays. I can't!
Shut up, kid.
Now, on today's Riker Scores, Harry Fails, we actually had a really hard time trying to figure out what we were going to do with this this segment.
But it seems clear after really analyzing.
Yeah.
This is a Kirk's fails.
It's so sad to say. It's like you always think Kirk is awesome, and Kirk is failing all throughout this film.
This is basically his youth is catching up on him. All the bad decisions that he made throughout this through his lifetime. You're seeing him in his 50s now, and now things didn't work out quite as well as he thought. He has, Khan comes back to haunt him, but he also has...
He took the admiral job. That's his first mistake. And then he you know, knocked up Carol Marcus, and then
never.
He came around a little bit because, I mean, he.
Yeah, David remembers something about Kirk.
Yeah, so David references that. So maybe, but maybe it wasn't just a one night stand.
It was a relationship, but obviously that Carol Marcus was like, I don't want to have a full blown relationship with you. You're too
Starfleety.
Yeah, and so from there, you know, he has a kid, and
he didn't know that it was his.
He wasn't aware, and it's one of those things that you know, he regrets it. Even in the Genesis cave, he's talking to Carol, and he says, you know, my son. He says, there's a man out there trying to kill me. If I haven't seen 15 years, trying to kill me, and you show me a son that would gladly do it for him. And he goes, my son is the life that I could have had, but I didn't, you know. And it's like he regrets it. He made a lot of bad choices. So
many regrets. And then his hubris keeps, you know, it gets the Enterprise damaged. And like the probably the one thing he loves more than Spock, or as much as Spock, is the Enterprise. And he just was like not listening to protocol. He knew better.
Yeah,
he really knew better. And he just.
Right.
Got caught with it. He literally says, "I got caught with my pants down."
Yeah, he says that after they just get away from. And that's one of the things. It's like, you know, sometimes we get comfortable of like certain things we do, and we think we're all right, and then we realize we've been not doing things correctly, and we're like, "I got a little lazy there." And Kirk even talks about it. Like I've been, you know, when he talks to his son, almost at the end of the movie, he says, "I've been, you know, cheating death." And patting myself on the back for my own ingenuity, you know.
Yeah.
And he's making all these. He's kind of got out of things. I mean, he cheated at the Kobayashi Maru.
But you know, he failed twice legitimately, so he just wanted to not lose anymore.
Yeah, but I mean, he cheated his way through all these things, and now he's finally feeling what happens when things don't work out, and you know, the bad decisions you make come back to haunt you. And I mean, not that. You know, having a kid is a bad decision, but he was not there. He was not
to see his kid
to be part
of
his life.
Which is regret and guilt and feeling like a failure in that aspect.
Right. And then, you
know.
Because
he could have done that, but he didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, it was crushing to him that Spock died, but then that, I mean, the movie doesn't really touch on this fact, but really it's his fault Spock died. Because he didn't listen to protocol, like as you said, like as I said a minute ago, he was caught with his pants down. They could have raised shields
before they showed up.
Yeah, I mean, if he followed protocol and raised shields whenever you know there's you know coming in contact with a ship that has not opened communications with you.
Spock sort of shuts Savick up there too.
I mean, yes, but I mean,
he's sort of like you know, like,
but still, Kirk knew better, and you know, Spock was trying to. Save the ego of his best friend and captain. So Spock was trying to be nice to Kirk, but Kirk knew better.
I agree with you there. And not just that, but as we were talking before, is that, you know, the fact that SETI Alpha 5 exploded and there was, or SETI Alpha 6 exploded and SETI Alpha 5 was obviously laid waste during that, there was nothing there to even, like, I don't know what happened, why they would not know that Khan. Like a criminal mastermind is on this planet, and there's nothing in records or there's no buoys or beacons that say like don't approach this planet, you know, kind of thing.
I know, like you know, Khan was saying, "Oh, why didn't you check up on us?" And like Khan didn't want to be checked up on. He was so proud of his superiority.
But I mean,
the only reason he said that was because the SETI Alpha 6 exploded.
No, I'm not just saying that, but I think that was part of Kirk's duty as well to somehow
like guide this new thing that
well,
he created.
Well, he was the reason he was there. That was his responsibility, and they should have maintained that. I mean, this is a whole lot of karma just coming back to bite him.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that it was his responsibility to say like, "Khan, are you okay down here?" But just like. Make the
do a scan.
Yeah. Yeah,
dude, do an orbital scan, drive by, and move on. He won't even know you're there.
Yeah, just
I mean, it could have been easy.
Yeah.
How many are there? Okay, good.
Right.
Beam down a crate of bananas or something.
Crate of bananas.
Yeah, you know, that way they got their potassium. They're Superman. They got to keep their potassium up.
Nice, yeah. All we got is goddamn bananas!
Yeah, you know, they would actually get more pissed off at that and start wanting steak at one point. So I really wouldn't do that to a bunch of, like, superpowered individuals.
Well, they have no way of getting back up to the ship.
Yeah. No, they would find one at that point.
They'd be climbing.
They'd climb.
They'd just,
use,
like,
all the trees.
They'd pile all the trees to a giant ladder in the sky.
No, but they wouldn't pile the trees straight up. They'd pile them on their side.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it would take like a million times more trees because they're not stacking them straight.
Right.
In a straight line.
Why is this taking so long?
What is going on here?
But yeah, so.
It doesn't look like SETI Alpha 5 ever had trees on it.
I think it did, but I think everything got like completely.
I mean, whatever you want to use.
Well, I mean, if you think of a planet's orbit of thing, there is probably huge volcanic activity. They probably burn half the planet.
Well, I mean, if
up.
The SETI Alpha 6 exploded, and explosions in space would be a ring, it would push it closer to the sun. And
or
so,
away.
Depending on what side of the force it was on.
Yeah.
Well, SETI Alpha 6 would be behind an orbit.
Mm-hmm.
If you're counting one being the one closest to the
sun.
So
you're saying it blew it further towards the sun.
Yes, which is why it's desert wasteland. It's
but not just that, but just the tidal force of getting hit by that.
Would have screwed up the planet.
It
anyway.
Probably flipped the orbit.
It would have tilted it.
Tilted it.
It would have messed with the axis and the poles.
Probably was a huge volcanic destruction. Like, there's probably volcanoes shooting off everywhere.
Yeah,
laying dust storms everywhere.
But I mean, that's also probably because it's closer to the sun, closer to the uninhabitable zone.
Oh, it's all that.
You know, all
ties
into
it. Yeah.
Realistically, in theory, it wouldn't have made the entire orbit change. It would have just changed the orbit into a U shape. Would give it more extremes,
right? Yeah, it possibly, and not just that, but it could have
make it elliptical instead of
yes, spherical. It would make it elliptical instead of spherical.
Not to mention,
yeah, but that'd still move it pretty close
if
to
that
sun in one way.
Oh yeah, it would get close, but then it would move very far away, so it would be in a severe state of flux.
And not to mention, just the explosion, there must be tons of asteroids just crashing into the planet constantly.
Oh yeah.
So. No more atmosphere at that point. I mean, that alone, whether it had pushed it closer to the sun or not, it would have destroyed the atmosphere for a very long time.
Or blasted the atmosphere away, yeah.
Blasted the atmosphere off the planet.
Filled it just with so much debris that there's no way for it to be possibly habitable.
I guess it depends on how big SETI Alpha 6 is. Was it a gas giant or was it something small like Mars?
It small and dense?
Yeah.
Like, the more dense that matter was, the more matter it would have had to actually...
Yeah, who knows?
And more matter would have survived.
It's one of those things, I mean, it's not really explained, but I mean, obviously any kind of explosion like that would definitely wreck havoc
on
any system. So, but I mean, just the little things like that. So we do see that Kirk's mistakes really catching up on him. And it's really comes down to, in the end, that Kirk should have, you know, done some other things with his life and keep up with. You know, keep up with those things, you know. He's got a kid. He's got a... Carol's never his wife, but...
Baby
it
mama.
Still counts as a love interest.
That's baby mama territory.
No matter what title you slap on it.
Yeah, so this is one of the things that I didn't really understand about the movie when I originally saw it as a young person, but now as older, it resonates more. Is that, you know, here he has like all these things that he's, you know, he's coming and
lots of regrets. So
yeah,
I could have done this. I should have done this.
Yeah.
It was the most human he was ever for me, and even having later gotten a little bit of a dislike for William Shatner, I have to say I still love him very, very much in this role. Like, this movie reawakened my old enjoyment of him as an actor.
Yeah.
Some other interesting trivia bits is that the time period of this movie takes place, if you remember Star Trek Generations, where he's got his perfect place in the Nexus where he's chopping wood and wanting to make breakfast for a woman who rides a horse.
Yeah.
They're saying this takes place before Wrath of Khan. So, like, that's interesting continuity that I never knew before reading Memory Alpha, that experience he had with that woman and maybe never coming back to Starfleet was in between the motion picture and the Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
And then he comes back. And so, I mean, that adds even more emotional weight to it because he had this, you know, he was almost going to leave Starfleet.
Right.
And never see Khan again.
Yeah. Which would have worked out for him.
I noticed something else in the movie, and maybe it was just me at the very beginning, but I was actually very surprised. I had to double-check the time on the movie, but Kirstie Alley swearing first thing at the very beginning of a movie made in 1982 got me completely by surprise.
Yeah, yeah.
Damn, from Vulcan in a captain's chair.
Yeah, yeah. It's
I mean,
cool.
I actually had to back it up and watch it three more times before it fully sank in. I was like, wait. She's got to be the only one that's ever sworn.
Well, the interesting thing is, in writing, Savick was a half Vulcan, half Romulan, which makes absolutely no sense to me because to me, Romulans and Vulcans are the exact same race. They just have different ideals. So, like, the biology.
Half or not, it's still amazing to see a woman brand new into a movie in 1982 swearing in her lines because that wasn't very common.
Right. I think you did see women swear and stuff like that, but it was something unusual for Star Trek for sure, because I don't think you really saw any swearing whatsoever.
Bones always said damn it.
Bones is constantly
He said swearing. Damn it at least once an episode.
Yeah, I guess you're right. You're right.
Yeah, but we're used to it from Bones. But, I mean, brand new character, right. New movie from Star Trek, and within the first 5 minutes...
No, you're right.
And I loved it. It wasn't that it was a shock value. It was just like, oh, my God. Yeah. Thank you.
No, it was definitely cool. Yeah, Kirstie Alley, unfortunately, I guess she didn't want to be typecast.
Which is so dumb because, like, everything I've read about her being in Star Trek 2 was that she wanted to be Spock for forever. She loved Spock. She adored Spock. And I don't understand why she'd just, like, not want to be in a second movie. I mean, that's all she was really going to be in.
Yeah, but there's, you know, who knows? I mean, back then...
She could have gotten stuck in that role and didn't want to be Cass's Star Trek and only Star Trek.
Well, she went on to Cheers, which was a huge for her. It was a huge TV show at the time. But then after that, she didn't really do... anything really big after that. I mean, she had some other movie roles, but they weren't anything as memorable that I can, like, put my finger on.
I can't think of her in any movies other than Star Trek.
I know she did a couple.
I'm sure she did, but I'm just saying I can't think of anything.
Yes.
Nothing so iconic.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was pretty big. And, you know, the actress that took over for her... didn't really have the charisma that Kirstie Alley had. Kirstie Alley had this definitely had. It wasn't just her beauty.
I love the looks.
Yeah,
like her expression, the deadpan but still extremely sarcastic eyebrow lift was just
right.
Perfect.
Oh yeah, she did an amazing job. I really like Kirstie Alley as Savick. I'm really sad she didn't come back in Star Trek III. I also liked her hair a lot.
Yeah,
because it wasn't the standard Vulcan bowl cut.
Yeah.
That we've come to see on almost every single Vulcan ever.
No, it was cool to see something a little different. And, you know, obviously they were trying to mix it up a little bit, too, for this movie. I mean,
too bad DePaul didn't have hair.
There's a lot of them that didn't. Well, no, but if you think about Spock's wife.
T'Pring.
Yeah,
she had hair.
She had hair. Or whatever she was, wife-to-be.
Or at least at least a wig.
Yeah, right. They wore wigs. So this is, I don't know, this is by far, I think, is one of the best Star Trek movies that are out there.
Go watch it.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, you should see it, because this is...
Remember Leonard Nimoy.
It's part of that, but also it's just one of those just superb...
Oh, it's perfect.
It's a good story, and it brings back all the characters from the original series, gets them back out there again, and gets you an opportunity to see them again in a very good role.
Yeah.
Perfect role. It's like it's night and day difference between the motion picture and this movie.
Motion picture. I mean, unless you really want to see it, I mean, I'm not going to say don't watch it.
Watch this and then watch motion picture.
But, you know, I almost feel like the motion picture isn't canon just by the way that the people are handled. Like, the characters just aren't fun.
I know.
It wouldn't be a Synthaholics episode if this didn't happen.
If you watch the original series and then you watch the motion picture and then you watch Star Trek 2.
Uh-huh.
Star Trek 2, the characters feel more like the characters in the original series.
Oh, yeah.
Different order. Trust me, it makes sense. Just have a few drinks. Try it.
My feeling is...
No, you got to watch 3 and then 4 and then go watch 1. And then it makes even less sense.
Actually, I think you should just watch 2, 3, 4, jump to 6, and then if you really want to go back, see motion picture. I mean,
if you need to sleep and pass out that night, put on motion picture, and then you'll dream about it the whole time.
Yeah, yeah, especially the whole the whole sequence of the Enterprise leaving Strydock is like, you know,
30 minutes long.
Yeah.
And then you get 45 minutes of it flying through V'ger.
Yeah.
Where nothing happens.
Nothing happens.
You know, maybe they just didn't calibrate things right on the ship and it really wasn't, you know, half impulse. So it was just a hell of a lot slower.
Well, no, it was just the little pod flying around it that took forever.
Yeah. Well, they're showing off the new design, which I got, but didn't have to be that long.
Yeah, they could have shown it off. Imagine
just it's just eye candy. Look how big and pretty my ship is. Isn't it shiny? Yeah. Oh, yay.
Well, I mean, obviously we're not talking about a motion picture, but I mean, at the time, motion picture was like 1979 or 78, and that was huge because nobody – I mean, like you hadn't seen Star Trek in over 10 years or around 10 years, so it was like everyone was super psyched. And everything was kind of revamped, too, so.
It would have been funny if the J.J.'s 2009 movie had a 30-minute shot of the new design of the Enterprise. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, that was a pretty drastic – that's as drastic, if not more so, than the original series to the movies was.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing to remember about those ships is back then, those were all full-scale models built by hand.
Yeah.
Oh, and every single one of those, including the destroyed ones, I mean, there are multiple versions of all of those ships.
Yeah.
And that's you know, I totally get one
the time show. Some like 20 feet long, like they were just huge,
mm-hmm.
But they were beautiful. And I love the design. I actually recently saw, speaking of models, like a model of Deep Space Nine, and it was gigantic. I mean, the guy was standing up underneath one of the lower pylons, and it was raised up off the ground, but still it wasn't raised that high off the ground, and he was like. Still underneath, like one of the pylons are reaching up, and it was mm-hmm. It's massive.
I totally act
that's
like
how
I
they
was
get
King
that beautiful
Kong.
Detail.
You break Deep Space Nine, that's so mean.
I'd be like, oh, King Kong, climb Deep Space Nine.
We should build you one out of like the styrofoam polys and paint it for you and just let you go for it.
I would totally do that too.
That's a lot of work. That's a lot of work just for Aaron to destroy something.
Oh, hell no, just stack up all the blocks. We'd have fun all day long.
So next episode, we're going to be talking about Into the Darkness next time we see Khan.
Well, so it can continue.
Khan.
Yeah, I know. David's going to make a bad joke that everyone makes fun of, and David will also talk about continuity errors.
Well, this is the thing is, like, as much as I absolutely love this movie – next episode, you're going to hear me probably say some harsh words.
Okay. Yeah, here's something new. Since we're Synthaholics, we've never talked about drinking games yet, but every time David mentions continuity, take a shot.
There you go.
Yep, that's not fair.
Say what?
I'd be drunk by the end of the episode. That's not fair.
Well, this is why I'm mentioning it at the end of the episode. That way they know for next episode that they can get their, you know, get their shot glasses ready.
Can I just put electrodes to you and every time you say I can just shock you?
No. See, that makes the drinking game less fun for the people who are playing at home.
Just give them a shock every time you mention continuity.
The home edition of Synthaholics.
We could actually link a page on the button or a button on the web page for it. So every time somebody says something, you can shock them by proxy.
Yeah.
You know how many people are paying attention?
It would be funny. It'd be funny too because if people listen to the podcast at their own leisure, so you're just being shocked like intermittently through the day. You're like, oh,
God, oh. You.
Gotta turn that button off.
People listen to this show to hear me rant about continuity issues.
Of course.
We should take a poll on
What continuity issue is he complaining about today? Let's find out.
And if you don't like listening to me talk about continuity issues, you should email us at Synthaholics@yahoo.com or join the Facebook discussion at facebook.com/groups/Synthaholics.
Yes. Join in the fun. We have some crazy talk.
We have lots of fun on the group, guys. I posted a picture of Riker and what happens on the holodeck stays on the holodeck. He's got two girls on his arms, and that – post went out of control.
Yes.
And it was lots of fun, and Aaron didn't participate, and pooey on him. Faith didn't participate either yet.
I have a reputation. I don't want to get into that mire.
What are you talking about? You're host on the show.
Huh?
I go battles.
Say it again.
I said I pick my battles wisely. I go for the ones I can win.
I don't think there's winning. I think everyone wins in the one I put up. especially Justin Dimmitt, who was very excited watching what was happening in the chat. So if you want to know what we're talking about, you should definitely check out the Facebook group.
Yeah. And I hope you enjoyed this episode. This is literally my favorite movie. I was so psyched about talking about this. So.
And if you thought it was the best episode we ever did, email us.
It's probably not the same.
Where, David? Where should they email us?
What's your personal email address, Aaron, if you didn't think this was the best one?
I don't think I'll give that out.
You can email us at sentthaholics@yahoo.com, and I can relate this to Aaron.
And I can. You can also just hit me on Twitter as well.
Oh, we'll also be, you know, if you email us at questions about Star Trek, we will read them on the air, and we will answer them. It doesn't have to be about the episodes that we're currently doing.
You can ask whatever you like.
Previous episodes, anything you want to hear about. We'll even take suggestions for episode topics and see what we can do with them.
Maybe your own take. So, like, maybe you saw Wrath of Khan and you got your own feelings or thoughts on it. You want to express those? We'll read it online, and we'll talk.
Agree or disagree vehemently. Whichever we feel like.
Right, exactly.
But it's all done in good fun.
Right. Cool, guys. Well, thank you so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed this episode.
From hell's heart, I stab at thee.
For God's sake, I spit at thee. No, we love you.
We love you for listening.
Come on back real soon.
We miss you, Paul. Jake will play some baseball with Cisco. Baseball.
That'll be a while.
Guys, before the banjos start playing.
Burr.
McCoy, get the banjo out.
Oh, good times, guys. Thank you all for listening. Live long and prosper. Thank you all for listening. All my music is provided by Warp 11. You can find them at warp11.com or follow them on Twitter at warp11. You can find us at synthaholics.com. You can email us at synthaholics@yahoo.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at synthaholicduo. If you'd like to follow us individually, you can follow me at David_J_Duncan.
You can follow me, Aaron O'Brien, at Blackbird2004. Faith, where can they find you?
You can find me at Faith Hertzberg.
And please subscribe to us. We are on iTunes. We are on Stitcher. And if you have a chance, please rate and review so we can improve. And any feedback is welcome. And so we can make the show even better for you.
Live long and prosper, guys. At the stars we did gaze. The next morning he left stinking of gin. Well, McCoy, my boy, come mix me a drink. Before the night's over, I'll puke in the sink. And we'll cry till we laugh. And we'll both shit our pants. You're the best drinking friend I ever had. I like how we all adopted the exact same pose this when the episode was over.
Oh god, I'm so stiff, my stretch. Oh shit, can't move.
It's all the same. It's like we all put our hands behind our head and leaned back.
Yeah.
Faith leaned into darkness.
Into the darkness.
Yes. Yay!
Yeah, wait, I am still recording.
Are you done?
Hey, you know, I just going to mention, before we start, when we did the intro last time, I could hear us breathing. I could totally hear us breathing. Just to let
actually, he has a point, because at a moment there, I was like, wait, did he do this just to fuck with me? Because it totally sounds like dirty breathing. Like, not even, like,
which
just
one?
Casual.
The Klingon one.
Oh, it did?
Number four. If you listen to four at the very beginning, you hear breathing.
Oh.
I don't know what it was. You just heard.
I usually try to cut it out.
It was like literally, don't worry about it. Just don't breathe.
You'll catch it if you're not paying any attention at all.